Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the military offensive underway against the Islamic State in northern Iraq near the Syrian border, involving U.S. Special Forces and 7,500 Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, who incidentally, due to falling oil prices, have not been paid in months. Max Hoffman, a political analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, joins us to discuss the capture of the important Highway 47 that cuts off the Islamic State in Mosul and shuts down their export of stolen oil from the main oil field they've captured. Then we'll look into the arrest on drug trafficking charges involving 800 kilos of cocaine by the DEA in Haiti, of the son and nephew of Venezuela's First Lady, who goes by the title of First Combatant. Javier Corrales, a professor of political science at Amherst College and author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, joins us to discuss the almost complete media blackout in Venezuela in reporting the arrests and how, once the news eventually filters out through social media, it will affect the upcoming December 6th elections for a new National Assembly. Then finally, we'll speak with an expert on Myanmar-Burma about the sweeping victory of Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, who in the first 5 months will transition the country away from a 25-year-long brutal and kleptocratic rule by a military junta that seized power after Ms. Suu Kyi won the country's first democratic election. An anthropologist who studies Buddhist practices, Julian Scioba, the director of the Center for Asian Research at Arizona State University, joins us to discuss the likelihood of a complete transition to democratic rule and the reasons why the military are giving up power, although they are retaining one quarter of the seats in parliament. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, who's a policy analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He's organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thank you for having me.
And the U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in northern Iraq have launched an offensive to retake the town of Sinjar from the Islamic State. And this is very significant, of course, because Sinjar was the town that was overrun by the Daesh, the Islamic State, where they slaughtered the men, imprisoned, raped, and took the jihadi brides of the women. And many of the Yazidis, which are a minority sect, a very ancient, somewhat exotic sect of Islam, they managed to escape up Mount Sinjar and eventually were led into the Kurdish areas by the Peshmerga. So this is a significant event, is it not? And it looks as though not only have they retaken Sinjar, they say they're now at the town hall, but they've cut across an important highway that is the main supply route, Highway 47, for all of the illegal, illicit, looted oil that the Islamic State takes to market.
That's right. Highway 47 is the route in question, and it's a key highway. It's the primary resupply route for Mosul, which is still the largest city under ISIS control in northern Iraq. It has been for over a year now, and so the Kurdish Peshmerga offensive was designed to sweep down from Mount Sinjar and cut that road, and that's very important. It will certainly hamper ISIS's ability to resupply their fighters in Mosul. It will also prevent them from shifting fighters between Mosul and Syria and Raqqa, their sort of base and their capital, as they call it. So it's an important tactical and military development. No question. It's not going to be absolute. This is open terrain, and it's a very long border that the KRG, the Kurdish Regional Government, shares with ISIS in this part of Iraq. So it's not as if they can stop out the fighters or the supplies entirely, but it's a big deal.
And what's your understanding of the U.S. role in amongst the 7,500 Peshmerga fighters? We know recently that an American Special Operations serviceman was killed in a raid, joint raid with the U.S. Special Forces and the Peshmerga in the same area to rescue a bunch of prisoners about to be executed by Daesh. So what's the extent of U.S. involvement in this offensive, to your knowledge?
Well, the full extent is of course classified, but there have been reports for over a year, almost since the initial weeks after the ISIS offensive, of covert U.S. presence among the Peshmerga, advising, helping draw up plans of attack, and also perhaps calling in airstrikes. So I think that continues. There are media mentions even today of U.S. Special operators among the Peshmerga. The most important U.S. role, of course, is the airstrikes. There have been coordinated and quite effective airstrikes over the last 24 hours, but this is the latest stage in in the long running air offensive against ISIS. And what that did from almost the beginning of the air offensive was it made it much more difficult for ISIS to move fighters around. They generally move. Initially, they moved in convoys of light vehicles, these pickup trucks, or tacticals as they call them when they put a machine gun on the back. And the U.S. persistent air cover and persistent surveillance from the air and airstrikes made it very hard for them to move in any large group or in any strength. So they've had to revert to sort of more guerrilla tactics and, move in ones and twos or on motorcycles, which makes it much harder for them to launch any sort of major offensive. And I think you've seen that. ISIS sort of hit its high water mark some time ago, and they're very difficult to push out and to completely sweep out of areas, but they're not, for the most part, launching major offensive, which is a very good thing.
But the U.S., though, these airstrikes, I'm curious to know, are these the planes that are flying from aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf, which is an extremely expensive undertaking where they don't have a lot of time because of all the in-flight refueling? We know that the U.S. has finally gotten some permission to operate out of the NATO base in Turkey, Incirlik. I don't know whether they're operating from the Kurdish north, but I don't believe the Iraqi government, who are at war with the Islamic State, are being particularly cooperative. So where are the U.S. aircraft coming from here in this operation?
Well, the U.S. actually just pulled its aircraft carrier from the Gulf, I believe. So there are land bases now in the Gulf which are still bearing the largest part of the load of the air campaign. But as you mentioned, Incirlik in Turkey was opened up in July to U.S. fighters, and then there's another air base, Diyarbakir, in the Kurdish part of Turkey, from which U.S. aircraft are flying. There have been reports in the media that there's a covert U.S. drone base in the Kurdistan regional area in northern Iraq, which would allow them to sort of have short flights to the front lines. There's no question that Turkey's delay made it more difficult for the U.S. in the early stages, but now that they have access to Turkey, they can fly from not far from these front lines in northern Iraq. The issue is that it's difficult to sort of move the whole logistical footprint of an air campaign to a new place. And so the Turkish footprint for the U.S. is still much smaller than it is in the Gulf. In the Gulf, these are long-term bases with big hangars and big runways and lots of supplies. And the U.S. has just been building up the presence in Turkey. But it's politically sensitive. Turkey, for example, has said that U.S. aircraft should not be flying from Turkish air bases to support the Syrian Kurdish fighters, the YPG, on the ground. It's unclear if that rule is being followed by the U.S., but it demonstrates the political sensitivity. Turkey fears that the YPG will only encourage Kurdish separatism in Turkey. So it's a convoluted situation, but the U.S. air campaign is central to this story and has been quite effective and has been quite effective at minimizing civilian casualties in contrast to the Russian air campaign.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, who's a policy analyst on the National Security International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He's organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. So when you just mentioned the Russians, my understanding is that initially the Russians were basically bombing the rebel groups in Syria that were causing the Assads the most problems, moving in, getting close to taking Damascus and Latakia, and that they basically left the Islamic State alone. But it's my understanding that since the bombing of the very likely terrorist bombing of the Russian airliner carried out by agents of the Islamic State, that Russia is really ramping up its attack on the Islamic State. So are they getting squeezed now with the U.S. and the Kurds? Because they're only, Sinjar's about, 30 miles from the Syrian border in Iraq, isn't it?
It's very close, yes.
Yeah. So give us a picture of the extent to which the Islamic State is on the defensive.
Well, there are, you know, setting the Russian air campaign to the side for a moment, because although they've begun to strike ISIS targets, the focus of the Russian campaign is really to save the Assad regime. And so they've been hitting the rebel groups that were, as you said, pushing into Latakia, the Assad regime's homeland, and were causing the most trouble there. They've begun to hit ISIS, but I think that's somewhat to the side for a moment. What's interesting here, so this campaign to Sinjar to cut off the supply, to take the Highway 47 and cut the supplies to Mosul, about 6 months ago, there was a lot of talk about establishing a perimeter around Mosul, which was, you know, this big ISIS stronghold, and then, you know, cutting the supplies so that eventually an offensive could be launched to retake the city. Then, in the last 2 months, there have been a series of moves by the U.S. to resupply Syrian, Kurdish, and Arab fighters in northwestern Syria who have been pushing ISIS back towards their capital of Raqqa. So what you see really are these two parallel slow-moving offensives against ISIS's two centers of gravity in Raqqa and in Mosul. I think the U.S. deployments of A-10 ground attack aircraft to Incirlik and again the Arab drop to Arab and Kurdish fighters in Syria, and the deployment of 50 U.S. special operators to Syria, they're all part of this this parallel offensive against Raqqa. So, you know, they're pushing against the center of ISIS gravity in Syria, the center of ISIS gravity in northern Iraq, and they're making slow progress. The difficulty really is that ISIS very rarely stands and fights a pitched battle because they know they'll be outgunned by the Peshmerga or the U.S.-backed Syrian YPG. So what they generally do is they set IEDs and they fall back and they wait for their opponents to kind of pick their way through the minefield, and then they'll try and strike somewhere else, and they'll try and keep their opponents off balance, and they'll try and infiltrate with car bombs and other unconventional tactics. So it's very difficult to sort of clear and then hold terrain against a group like that. But slow progress seems to be taking place. What's interesting here is that, you know, for the first time we're seeing some momentum in Iraq. It had been basically a stalemate for some time. Hopefully we'll see some momentum in Syria soon too. But the U.S. is pursuing these offensives primarily with Kurdish partners, but with Kurdish partners who see the world very differently and have very different goals. The YPG, basically a leftist Kurdish militia in Syria, and then the KDP militia in around Mosul and Sinjar, which is a sort of a conservative militia based around the Barzani clan. So it's interesting, and it demonstrates that the U.S. is being fairly pragmatic in cooperating with whoever can push ISIS back on the ground, underneath that U.S. air campaign.
But is that to say, Max Hoffman, that the U.S. is finally waking up to how useless the Iraqi government in Baghdad is? I mean, it's such a corrupt government, and they promised some time back to take Mosul, and they haven't moved, and it took them forever to retake other towns like Tikrit from the Daesh. They've proven to be completely useless. The U.S. still basically seems to treat them as the legitimate government of Iraq, even though they seem to be more loyal to the Russians and the Iranians than they are to the Americans, after all, in terms of the U.S. treasure and lives lost in that ill-fated Iraq war. So I'm just wondering where that stands now, because this is clearly, in dealing with the Kurds, they've had to somehow go around the Iraqi government, who hasn't been supplying the Kurds with arms. So the U.S. must be supplying them independently of Baghdad. What's your understanding about that relationship between the U.S. and the Kurds and the U.S. and the government in Baghdad?
Well, the U.S.-Kurdish relationship is still quite strong. U.S. special operators have long-standing relationships with the KRG and with the Peshmerga. So, you know, that's why I think the cooperation in the north with the Kurds seems to be going so much better. In the south, there's deep frustration on the U.S. side, certainly. You know, the U.S. was successful in sort of nudging former Prime Minister Maliki Assad, who had been very divisive and had really contributed to this crisis by excluding Sunnis. But, you know, Prime Minister Abadi has much better intentions and has acted, you know, has taken some good steps, but he's held back because his governing coalition is essentially the same Shia governing coalition that Maliki headed up. So he is somewhat limited. He's been supported by Ayatollah Sistani, who's the, you know, preeminent Shia authority in Iraq and hugely respected and a very powerful figure. But Iraqi politics is quite corrupt. It's you know, it's all about securing government jobs and salaries for your network, and it's all about patronage. So people are reluctant to reform, even in the face of such a, you know, such a huge threat as ISIS. That said, the U.S. military cooperation with the Iraqi security forces is continuing in the south, but the Iraqi security forces are really not very effective. And the Shia militias, who the U.S. refuses to cooperate, quite rightly, given their human rights record and their intentions, you know, are a more powerful force. So you're right. It's a very difficult situation in the south with the Iraqi government. In the long term, whether it's Mosul in the north or, you know, Tikrit or Ramadi or, you know, the rest of Anbar province in southern Iraq, the fundamental difficulty is that there is no powerful Sunni politics left in Iraq with whom to negotiate an alternative to ISIS. ISIS, unfortunately, was very brutally effective in targeting through bombs and assassinations the Sunni political leaders with whom the U.S. worked in the awakening in 2006, 2007, 2008, and also, you know, with whom you would work to kind of piece Iraq back together. So I think you're very right to be skeptical that we can ever, from Washington, sort of bring these parties all together. I think the U.S. policy now is to try and have these parallel offensives going with the Syrian Kurds and towards Raqqa, with the Iraqi Kurds towards Mosul, and with the Iraqi government into Anbar province, and then hope that some sort of federalism will, you know, can be established in which the parties at least aren't at each other's throats and can, you know, ideally share the oil revenues and begin to piece their country back together. But at the moment, that remains, you know, far from reach.
Well, it's. I think it was very telling that the U.S. couldn't get Iraq to agree to stop the Russians from flying over their territory into Syria to rescue Assad, and the U.S. was informed of Russia's bombing campaign in Syria by the Russian military attaché at the embassy in Baghdad, who dropped by the Green Zone to let them know about a half an hour before the Russians started to drop bombs. So it would indicate that there's some question about the loyalty of this government in Baghdad. And just to touch on the YPG, in the Syrian Kurds, my understanding is that they can't really venture too far out of their area into the Sunni areas to go after the Islamic State in Raqqa because the place is so sectarian. Is that your understanding?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Russian attaché dropping by and, you know, notifying the U.S. about the air campaign half hour before. It's apparently the Turkish airstrikes against the PKK, which is, you know, their formerly separatist Kurdish militant group, which is also fighting in Syria alongside the YPG. They conducted airstrikes against the PKK and also apparently gave the U.S. about 10 minutes warning of that air campaign. So I think, you know, across the region, you see a number of players pursuing their regional interests, you know, either in parallel when the U.S. interests align or on their own. To your question, yes, I mean, the Syrian YPG have been very effective against ISIS, pushing them out of the, you know, northwestern part of Syria. They've kind of reached the limits of the majority Kurdish areas, and they, in fact, have occupied a few majority Turkmen or majority Arab areas. It's very kind of convoluted in that part of the country. And they've been reluctant to journey further because it's, you know, ISIS is stronger in the Sunni areas, and the Kurds don't have as much will to fight sort of out of their own home territory. The U.S. is hoping to persuade them to push south towards Raqqa, but I think more of that hope is based around The idea that the Arab militias, small Arab groups which are fighting with the Kurdish, Syrian Kurds right now, can be convinced to sort of head that offensive and put an Arab face, an Arab Sunni face on this offensive. At the moment, those Arab groups fighting with the YPG in Syria are too small to undertake that scale of an offensive, I believe. But we'll see. The other limit placed on the Syrian Kurds, of course, is from Turkey. The U.S. is, you know, nominal ally in all of this, and where we're launching the airstrikes, part of the airstrikes from. Turkey has said that they fear the Syrian YPG. They fear the establishment of an independent or, you know, pseudo-independent Kurdish enclave on their southern border in Syria. And they've said that if the YPG crosses the Euphrates and goes any further to the west into a sort of a Sunni and Turkmen area, that they'll hit the Syrian YPG, which, of course, would then have the situation where the U.S. is launching airstrikes from Turkey in support of the Syrian YPG, while Turkey is hitting the Syrian YPG for violating their red line. So it's a deeply complicated situation, and you know, the U.S. is trying to referee everybody and keep everybody focused on ISIS, but everyone has their own grudges to settle and their own territory to control. So it's pretty tough for anyone sitting in Washington to square that circle.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, who's a policy analyst on the National Security International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He's organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the arrest by the DEA in Haiti of the son and nephew of Venezuela's first lady on drug trafficking charges.
Se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College, who serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly. And he's also been a consultant to the United Nations, the Center for Global Development, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. And his latest book is U.S.-Venezuelan Relations Since the 1990s, Coping with Mid-Level Security Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Javier Corrales.
Thank you very much.
And the arrest in Haiti of two nephews of the wife of the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. In fact, one of the two men considers himself a son. He was essentially brought up as a son of the first lady, Celia Flores, and the other is a nephew. They were both on diplomatic passports when they were arrested, planning to import 800 kilos of cocaine into New York, and now they've been flown into by the DEA into New York, and they're being arraigned in New York on Thursday. But what's curious is there's absolutely nothing about this in the press in Venezuela. There's a complete information blackout about this arrest. So how do you explain that?
Yes, a couple of things. There have been many allegations that Venezuela is becoming or has been becoming a narco state. This means that important figures in the government are closely connected to drug trafficking and criminal rings, international criminal rings. But we don't have a lot of evidence. We do have a lot of investigations. The United States government, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Treasury Department are investigating individuals. So this arrest is the closest evidence that we have, or the strongest evidence that we have, that some of these drug operations are taking place by folks who are very close to very high officials in government, the president and the first lady in this case. So it's a very important development. Why is it that this isn't being covered by the official media in Venezuela? Well, the government controls most of the TV channels and most of the print media. And this government is becoming increasingly authoritarian and increasingly controlling of the information. It is remarkable how little coverage of it there has been. There hasn't been an official pronouncement from the government yet, and only independent media have mentioned it. So there is no question that the Venezuelan government is not interested in making any comment. And so if you do not have access to independent media, you probably have not heard of this story in Venezuela just yet.
Well, President Maduro, who's on a visit to the Gulf to meet with Saudi Arabian and Gulf leaders, he tweeted rather obliquely, "Neither attacks nor imperial ambushes will affect the people of the liberators. We have only one destiny, victory." So not exactly on target there, but presumably he's referring to these arrests rather obliquely.
That is right. And you can contrast that with something that happened also this week. The Secretary General of the OAS sent a letter to Venezuela's director of the institute that supervises elections, criticizing Venezuela very strongly for the way that they're managing the elections for the national legislature, which are going to take place December 6th. It's a very critical letter, even accusatory letter. The response of the government to that letter was very different from the response that you have described. They responded very aggressively, very publicly. They discussed it everywhere. They denied all the charges. They challenged the Secretary General. They made a big deal about it. But as you say, the response to what is happening in New York with these arrests has been pretty tame, very quiet, and they're hoping that nobody finds out. They don't have a response, actually. They don't know what to say other than to simply repeat the argument that this is all part of an imperialist conspiracy against the government of Venezuela.
And this is not the first arrest, though, is it? Or at least a charge of high-level officials in the Venezuelan government. There was the head of the National Assembly. He was being investigated on drug trafficking charges. And then last year, the former head of the Venezuelan Intelligence Service, Hugo Caraval, was arrested in Aruba on, at the request of the U.S., and there were indictments accusing him of being on the payroll of Colombian drug traffickers. But the Arubans didn't send him to the United States. They allowed him to return to Venezuela. So what is the situation? Because the U.S. authorities are claiming that Venezuela has become the main source or conduit, I should say, of cocaine coming out of Colombia.
I think almost everybody who follows stories about drug trafficking in the Americas agree with the fact that ever since 2005, when Venezuela significantly reduced the ability of the Drug Enforcement Administration to operate in Venezuela, Venezuela has become a safe haven for drug traffickers. And a lot of the drugs that are being produced in the Andean region find their way out into the Caribbean, Central America, Mexico, and eventually the United States, are doing so through Venezuela. There is very little cooperation between the United States and the Venezuelan government. In fact, no cooperation at all. And this is one of the reasons why many folks think that the reason there's no cooperation is because the Venezuelan state is very implicated with many of these transnational drug trafficking links. So what the United States has been doing is it is trying to avoid engaging in a political fight with the government itself. So what the United States is doing is to let the Drug Enforcement Administration, together with the Treasury Department, investigate individual figures and trying to see whether they can collect enough evidence to indict them or even arrest them. They haven't been that successful. We don't know how many indictments have been prepared and are unsealed, but you mentioned the Carvajal one in Aruba. That was a big one that failed because the Dutch government blocked that extradition to the United States. And this is probably, to my mind, probably the biggest arrest that the United States has made. But several other Venezuelan officials or former government officials have been formally indicted in the United States. And they have not been extradited, but yes, essentially this is what the United States policy toward Venezuela currently consists of, which is trying to avoid an open confrontation with the Venezuelan government, but going after individuals who are believed to be involved in illicit transnational activities.
So clearly the situation in Venezuela is getting more and more tense. There's been an enormously high crime rate for the longest time, lots of shortages of basic supplies like toilet paper, etc. The country goes to the polls on December the 6th to elect a new National Assembly, and the indications are that the opposition will win, and the government of Maduro, which is now, of course, obviously, eventually this information will get out about the son and nephew of the First Lady being arrested and taken to the United States on drug charges, will eventually make its way. I think it's already getting into the social media in Venezuela because censorship ultimately doesn't work, although it's very effective in a broader sense. I just can't understand how a country that is so rich in oil could be so screwed up. And the wheels are coming off the entire operation. And, you know, at the end of the day, leftists here in the United States, particularly this radio network I broadcast from, blindly support Maduro. But I don't think it does socialism any good when a country is so mismanaged.
Absolutely. This is everyone's big question. How can it be that the country with the largest levels of oil reserves, more oil reserves than Saudi Arabia, that just underwent one of the most significant oil windfall in the history of the oil industry, which is between 2003 to 2013, that received such a large supply of dollars, is in such bad shape? Well, essentially, the country squandered this wealth. A lot of it did go into social programs, but I think most people are convinced that a lot of it went into very inefficient and corrupt deals. So that even during boom times, Venezuela was running deficits, was increasing its debt, was neglecting investments in the oil company, and was punishing the private sector so that the private sector itself wasn't even investing either. So even before the price of oil dropped in 2004 the way that it has, Venezuela was already pretty much close to bankrupt and without much to show for after almost 10 years of spectacular external economic conditions. And so precisely because it misused its its oil windfall, it was caught very unprepared for the decline in oil prices, and so it is now having one of the worst economic crises in the world. And this explains why the government is very worried as it approaches the December 6th election. It knows that there is widespread anti-incumbent sentiment, and they're very worried about what that's going to mean on election day.
Well, but I think the opposition is also worried, aren't they? That because Maduro has said some rather ominous things. He said, you know, in acknowledging the upcoming elections, he said, whichever way they turn out, nevertheless, the revolution is going to continue. And nobody quite knows what he means by that. What do you think he means?
Well, you know, it could mean, let me just give you a generous interpretation, and I'm going to also give you a scary interpretation. The generous interpretation is to say, look, this is just going to be an election for the National Assembly. The cabinet is not going to change. Many democracies, even the United States, have midterm elections. And even if the government loses, that doesn't mean that the government is going to come down or that policies are going to change. So there's a little bit of that. And that is true. This is a midterm election, and it's for Congress. But the scary interpretation is that this government will do all that it can to not recognize the results, to cheat, use every trick in the books to try to prevent this inevitable electoral outcome. And even if the opposition ends up winning, that they will do all that they can between Election Day and the day that the National Assembly takes office to undermine the powers of the Congress, to change the rules, to maybe even give President Maduro decree powers to last him 2 years or something like this. So we'll have to see which of these two versions we're going to see, whether we're going to see a government that responds to this result the way that many governments in democratic regimes respond to bad midterm elections, or are we going to see an autocratic response whereby the government will simply either engage in cheating or even in ways to devalue the role of Congress in Venezuela's political life?
Well, Javier Corrales, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College, who serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly, and has also been a consultant to the United Nations, the Center for Global Development and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. And his latest book is U.S.-Venezuelan Relations Since the 1990s, Coping with Mid-Level Security Threats. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the sweeping victory by Aung San Suu Kyi's National League of Democracy in Burma. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Julianne Schober, who's a professor of religious studies at Arizona State University, where she's also the director of the Center for Asian Research and co-director of graduate studies in religious studies. An anthropologist who works on Buddhist practices in Southeast Asia, especially in Burma, Myanmar, she is the author of Modern Buddhist Conjectures in Myanmar, Cultural Narratives, Colonial Legacies, and Civil Societies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julianne Schober.
It's a pleasure to join you today.
And President Obama has congratulated Ms. Suu Kyi, who her party had an extraordinary victory in the recent elections in Myanmar, Burma, and the president called for a more peaceful and prosperous future. Why do you think it is that the military, I mean, in a sense, we're back to the future here. You know, 25 years, in effect, were lost when Aung San Suu Kyi won the election 25 years ago, and then the military simply revoked the results and took over. So 25 years later, why do you think they've essentially relinquished, at least apparently so, to the will of the people, in this case, 80% of the people?
Well, as Aung San Suu Kyi has said in her interview to the BBC a few days ago, it's different people involved in this transition of power this time. And I suppose, as skeptical as many of us have been, there were some groundbreaking changes initiated in the past 5 years, so that hopefully a transition of power is actually possible this time. And she's come out and has said she wants to initiate a national reconciliation with the military. There have been peace process negotiations going on with nationalities for the past however many years. And if she can infect a positive dialogue in these areas, I hope that she will succeed at doing this. It's a huge challenge. It's a challenge perhaps also because it's in a way the same players, although the roles have been reversed now with this election. She is no longer under house arrest, but in fact now she is in power. And so the military, while no longer in absolute power, still has important positions in the cabinet and will continue to do so. So it will be really important to get a positive dialogue, national reconciliation underway soon. And she's offered to do that, and her counterparts have agreed to such a meeting in the near future. So much depends on the willingness of all parties involved to effect a positive transition this time around.
Well, Myanmar's military chief has said the military would do its best to cooperate with the new government during the post-election period, and the military-installed president, if you will, has pledged that his government will respect the people's decision and choice and will hand over power as scheduled. But the schedule that he's talking about is 5 months long, is it not?
It is a long time. Certainly by our standards, that's a very long time for a democratic transition to take place. On the other hand, Myanmar is a country where there are a great many infrastructural needs. And so to build, and at the same time, there's sort of a shortage of capacity and a great need for capacity in public administration and so on. So it will take time to put together an effective government with ministries being covered by people with experience in these areas and so on. So it's a challenge, not just in terms of politics, but also in terms of just the practicality of staffing various positions with individuals who have experience in these fields. So 5 months may not be a long time for that kind of transition, because she will have to build much of that infrastructure. Her associates will have to build much of that infrastructure. It's not readily there already. So it's a long time, and in other ways, it's also a short time to mount a completely different kind of governmental structure.
So, given the 5 months transition period, which I think, you know, by nature makes one nervous a little bit, since the transition is so long, you also have to add in that the military have reserved 25% of the seats in the parliament for themselves, so they're clearly not going away. And they control the police as well, don't they? You know, so you got the military and the police, which is fairly powerful organs of the state.
Yeah, they will remain not only with the 25% quota that's prescribed by the Constitution, but also the Constitution mandates that they hold National Defense Ministry, the police, and also Ministry for Border Affairs. So those are all the ministries that have to deal with, the enforcement of law, if you so will. And that's, of course, that will be a test on the professionalism of the military, I suppose, in coming years. And it will always be require careful dialogue and hopefully accommodation on all sides. Key to a successful administration, in my view, is establishing a federal system that will allow participation from various minority groups that are geographically bordering the core Burman regions of the country. So federal government has been on the drawing board for some time, but so far power has still been very hierarchically structured in that the central government appointed the regional ministers. And so if there is actually true federalism, then I think then there would also presumably be greater collaboration and participation, which should help agenda of the National League for Democracy. And it should also minimize the need or perceived need for law enforcement, either through military or police means. And hopefully that will lessen then the chances of incursions or warfare or other sources of violent tension that we've been hearing about in recent times in Myanmar.
So why do you think then the military relinquished power, given their obstinance, their brutality, their greed, their megalomania and building huge palaces for themselves and showering their relatives with all kinds of lavish gifts and basically stealing the country blind? Why did they decide to give up power?
Well, I think that the generals in power 25 years ago are from a different generation than the ones in power today. And the just-passed president, Thein Sein, has said himself that he wanted to embark upon democratization because he perceived that Burma was falling too far behind compared to its neighbors in the region. So I think there is a recognition among generals, among the military elite, broadly speaking, that the country needs to move forward on a different path in order to create a viable future for the next generation. And that's everybody's children. The military as well as those who are in less powerful positions. So I think there's that kind of recognition that new venues have to be embarked upon to promote standard of living in a country that's really rich in natural resources. And so how that process will unfold, how those resources will be used in a marketplace is, of course, something that needs to be thought about and administered with great care. It's not, and certainly some people have managed to maneuver advantages for themselves and their families and so on. But I think on the whole, there is a recognition that Burma is in need of development and in need of capacity building. And so that, I think, may well be an impetus behind the willingness to work towards a transition of power now. Now, to what extent what that will look like in reality, I think, is still anyone's guess, and we just have to wait for the future to unfold to really know. But I think that's the reason for the desire to open up and to move the country out of this self-imposed isolation.
So what happened, though, in terms of the transition a few years ago, where it looked as if Burma had become pretty much a client state of China, and they were even going to reverse the rivers so that they'd flow back into China, and God knows what kind of environmental consequences it would have had for Myanmar, Burma. But it seems as though there was a recognition, I don't know how broad it was, that Burma was getting sort of to become too much a client state, and they kind of reasserted themselves?
Yes, I think there is that recognition that Burma did not want to be a client state of China alone and not have equally strong relationships with other nations. And that was precisely where I think the country was at in 2010. Now, it's not to say that China no longer has strategic interests in Myanmar. Of course they do, and of course they are present in many industries, but they are not the only source of aid for development, and so the EU has been very proactive in helping to establish think tanks and building capacity, and the U.S. has been involved in similar efforts, as has Canada and Britain and so on. So there are now options for Burmese to expand their own interactions with internationally, and they are no longer beholden to just one venue through China. And that, too, I think is, in a way, an assurance to even the military, because remember, Burma was among the first non-aligned states, and that sort of ideology of, you know, we should be not aligned with anyone, but broadly have relations internationally across political spectrums. I think that is still a thinking that is in part found among the current military elite. And so it's something that's appealing even to them.
So in terms of the election, the winner, Aung San Suu Kyi, said that the Burmese people are far more politicized now, and of course 30 million people voted who were eligible to vote turned out. That's an estimated about a turnout of 80%. But nevertheless, hundreds of thousands of the Muslim Rohingya minority, they don't even have citizenship, and we've seen the exodus of Rohingyas crossing the Andaman Sea, you know, and being in kind of held in limbo, and it's been a very public exodus and something of a humanitarian catastrophe. What is going on in terms of the relations with the Muslim minority, and what is the source of this mistreatment?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the source of the mistreatment, I suppose, is a public ideology or a public discourse that has been very prevalent in the 90s and 2000s, where power, political power and military power has been equated with a Burmese Buddhist identity. And that was a particularly powerful appeal in the absence of a national constitution. Now, increasingly, the younger generation and more democratically inclined public figures have come to insist that Burma is a multi-religious and multi-ethnic country. And that's why federalism and how it is implemented will be such an important aspect and means for diminishing ethnic and religious tensions. It used to be in Burma 2-3 decades ago that religious identity was not at all marked in any way. And, you know, you might be Buddhist and you might go to the houses of your Christian and Muslim friends and celebrate their holidays. It was perfectly acceptable, and the more the merrier was sort of the way people looked at that. Today, I think that's quite different, obviously, and religion has become a marked category. Now, it'll be important to pursue public policies that will diminish those kinds of divisions. And you can do that by, you know, providing education access and by, you know, recognizing difference as an asset for the country's development overall. So it will be important to help in this regard. But specifically with the exodus of the Rohingya, that is an altogether complicated and very sad development that has been taking place in Arakan, which is the region of Burma that borders Bangladesh. And one might argue that, you know, the border between Bangladesh and Burma is really an invention of the colonial and post-colonial era. The Bay of Bengal was historically a region where people traveled across borders and had white networks across the region, and movement of people back and forth was quite to be expected. And today that's become a different story, in part because of this emphasis on religious difference. So I think that a national community has to find ways to integrate difference and to make that a source of pride rather than exclusion.
Well, Julianne Schober, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Julianne Schober, who's a professor of religious studies at Arizona State University, where she's also the director of the Center for Asian Research and co-director of graduate studies in religious studies, an anthropologist who works on Buddhist practices in Southeast Asia, especially Burma, Myanmar. She is the author of Modern Buddhist Conjectures in Myanmar, Cultural Narratives, Colonial Legacies, and Civil Societies. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down to the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.